Hello, I'm Paul Yeager, and this is the MTOM Show podcast, a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. Welcome to my hometown. This is Jessup, Iowa, getting ready for the Farmers Day celebration. And this is Farmers State Bank, and president of this bank for a long time was Albert Sparky Durow. Full disclosure, my former banker, my family's family bank that we were involved with during our farming operation, and someone who is involved in the community. You've heard me talk with bankers before about their involvement in town. Well, we're going to do that. Sparky was president at a time in the 1970s and 80s. You can guess where this discussion is going to go. We're going to talk about what it was being like making some tough decisions in agriculture and in banking for the benefit of this community and other communities in Iowa about the role agriculture played. After Spark was done on the day-to-day operations of banking, he got into farming, also got into sheep, as well as restoring Oliver tractors. We'll talk about both of those industries and traveling around the country and just how small of a world it really is. So here we go. Enjoy this installment of the MTOM Show podcast. When you were a kid, did you think banking was always going to be what I did?
No, I don't think so. I loved high school sports. Worked for farmers all the time, so I thought maybe I'd farm, but I went off to college, Wartburg College, your alma mater, for 2 years, and then I finished at Iowa State University with a BS and did some graduate work at UNI in Wisconsin and Harvard and came back to the hometown and went to work in the bank.
Was agriculture on your mind? I mean, you went to some – Wartburg's not known for being an agriculture school. Iowa State is.
Yeah, that's – part of the reason I transferred to Iowa State because I majored in ag business or ag economics at the time. So that's how I ended up at Iowa State.
Was there something that switched, someone that changed your mind about, hey, this is kind of fun?
No, I don't think so. I just, you get a little older and a little more mature and decide what you want to do in life, I guess, as I look at it. I had to go to Iowa State, though. My father went, my grandfather attended Iowa State, graduated from Iowa State in the 1890s, and so on.
Well, as you know, my father went to Iowa State, wanted me to go to – wanted all of us to go to Iowa State, and none of us did. You know, here I went to – two of us went to Wartburg, so we still didn't listen to him. You come back to town. What was the game plan?
Well, I went to work in the bank, and I remember my father the first day sent me out front to sweep sidewalk because that's where he started. But I worked in the bank, and then my father's health failed within a year or two, and then I guess I was running. And very fortunate, he sold it to me when I was 27 years old to control the bank. Because his health was had deteriorated to the point where he couldn't work anymore, and went along from there. And who are your customers in a small town in Iowa? They're mostly agriculture related. So I was happy for that background.
What year was that?
He sold me the bank. I'd have to figure it out.
It was before the '70s.
Yeah. I was born in 1945, so it'd be 1972. He sold it to me.
Yeah. So 1972. We haven't hit the inflation yet of the 70s, but that came real quick. So you had like 3-4 years before things came and changed in a hurry. What?
16-20% interest, and we never got that high in rural banks, but it was a real challenge how you're going to handle it and how you did it. But then it came to the 80s, and then it just kind of collapsed and got a lot tougher.
There's nothing in a book that can prepare you for that time. What was, I mean, I was going to save the heavy stuff for later, but geez, I guess we'll jump into that now. What, banks were going under everywhere. Farmers were going under everywhere. Yeah. How did you survive?
Well, we did an awful lot of farmers' home loans. We actually went out and picked up a lot of new customers and did farmers' home loans because the Production Credit Association was going to foreclose on them, and we worked them through it and settled with PCA on some and helped other ones. And I did a certain amount of counseling with some that never did business with me and helped them through it. It's pretty tough. I guess my least favorite memory is having to tell somebody who he had to change what he was going to do the rest of his life. And he didn't go home. He disappeared. And he was gone for a day or two. And it scared me. I thought he'd committed suicide or something. No, he just wanted a job, and he went to Waterloo and slept overnight in his truck, and he worked up and down the street until he found a job in Waterloo. So he had a job so he could go home and tell his wife that he couldn't farm anymore, but he had a job. It scares you, life, you know, what it does to people.
Were there a lot of days where you, I'll just say it, dreaded coming to work at that time?
No, I don't think that much. We were too busy, you know. When you just start doing Farmers Home Guaranteed loans, it's astronomical amount of paperwork. I remember going to Washington, D.C. with the Iowa Bankers and lobbying, and the person in the Farmers Home Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture said, well, these applications are easy to fill out. I told him, I had a degree in agriculture, and I've been to graduate school, and I had damn hard to fill out, and it's almost impossible sometimes to get them done correctly, and your guys are saying they're written so you, a seventh grader, can fill them out. You're crazy. But it was, you just had to stay at it. There's a tremendous amount of detail to do in one.
Was the bank, you talk about the Iowa Bankers. I've discussed with them about the ag economy of today. It's not the same. It's still based on the same things. But were there other organizations that helped guide you to figure out a path for the bank? Or was that just something your gut figured out worked for this community and how you guided things inside these walls?
I had three or four close friends that were in banking, and we talked an awful lot. And you either worked at it or you were going to go under. In other words, you had to switch to Farmers Home. The examiners were very difficult to work with when they came in and examined you. But they tried to be fair, but yet at the same time, it was so difficult to meet their regulations, so to speak. But you just kept pushing away at it, kept working and working and working. You finally got through it all.
Do you still see some of those farmers that made it through then around town?
Yes, and they came right on back in the 80s, or after the 80s and the 90s, or thousands in the last 20, 30 years, and were very successful, had good, productive lives, and left a lot for their families when they finally passed on. You know, they made it, but there probably was more of them that needed to, but you couldn't hardly do it, get everybody.
What was the, not say scenario, but what was the makeup of trying to figure out who was going to get a chance to farm another year or two? How was that determined? I mean, was it all balance sheets? Was it age of the farmer? Was it?
Almost all balance sheets. Age didn't make much difference. Yeah. And what you could do if, you know, family, and just so many things on each one of them, you know.
Was there something that came from that time period that has made a small town in Iowa better today?
I guess that's kind of a difficult question. I can't answer that.
I mean, there's always the, we think about pulling ourselves up from our bootstraps. Yeah. But when the bootstraps are so high and choking us off, it's hard to do.
Well, coming out of Iowa State and looking at our small community, we were shipping 1 million bushels of corn a year out of town. I mean, they were loading it up on the siding and putting it in boxcars at the time and putting boards over the doors, and off it went to the Gulf. And that was a little bit of our problem. We only have two crops, and we were moving out of the area of the dairy around here. And what were you going to do? Well, let's figure out something we can do with that 1 million bushels of corn. And it took us 20 years, 25 years, and we got to the point where a few years ago they tore the siding out of the local co-op because they hadn't shipped any grain for 4 or 5 years, and they didn't want to spend the money to restore the siding, and the railroad wanted them to put all this money in the siding. And they said, we don't need it. We're bringing corn in all the time. We encouraged the guys to go into hogs. We built lots of modified open-front hog units and financed those. We were involved with sow units. In other words, use that corn that was being shipped out locally. Jobs in the elevator, jobs in the feed store, more income for the farmer.
Diversity.
Diversity is the biggest thing. Yeah. So you're not just hinged on two crops, corn and soybeans.
I mean, this co-op, I know, still, you know, they're grinding it up and sending it out.
Yeah.
And now you've got some operations so big that are doing it on their own site.
Yeah.
They don't come through town.
Yeah.
Has that been good?
Yeah, it's all good. The more livestock, the better it is for the community because they have the money to spend. And some people say, well, they might smell, but things have changed there big time too, because I'd say about 99.9% of manure around us is all knifed in the ground, and neighbors just don't have any idea you spread manure that day. I mean, we took care of that part of the problem, the odors and things. But you try to be good citizens and manage it. They have our city carnivals going on uptown. So you got a Boy Scout booth, which I've been involved with for years and years. And I just stopped up there and had a pulled pork sandwich. And Tyson's gave us 800 and some pounds of butts to cook, and they cooked them for 16 hours, and they're having pulled pork sandwiches. The local pork producers gave us all the tenderloin, all the loins to make tenderloin sandwiches for 2 or 3 days. And then somebody else donated the ribs for the meat and stuff. It's all local. It's all local support, and they want to be good neighbors, and they are.
And now, I've already eaten today, but now I need to know, I now know where I'm going. I was going for a bratwurst with the Lions Club tonight.
Yeah.
I mean, that's always one of
that's
the things
too.
That I always like to do.
Yeah.
The community, when you walk down the street and you know, people still know you as the banker, even though you've not held regular hours in a while, they still know you. Does it still feel good to mean to walk around this community?
Oh, I don't know. I know all the old people. I don't necessarily know the younger ones, but yeah, I've always enjoyed life, and I always talk to anybody or, you know, outgoing. So yes, I do enjoy people.
This bank is on 6th Street in Jessup, Main Street, where people come through. There is a facade that's different of your bank, just which is like the facade in this office.
Yeah.
What was the? How did the rocks come about?
We decided, because we'd gotten larger, too large for our older building, that we had to build a new building. And I don't know, somehow I dreamed up a few different things to do a new building, and one of them was the rocks. Every spring around here, we go out and we pick up rocks, and my daughter, that's your age, Paul, went out and picked up rocks and put them on the hay rack. So I put a big sign up in the front yard, Future Home of Farmer State Bank, deposit your rocks here. One Tootsie Roll paid for every rock deposited. And so when the kids were picking up rocks, the farmers brought them in and made a hell of a pile of rocks here. And then we had to sort those all out into the parking lot when we got the building about done. And then they laid up two fireplaces and the outside wall of the bank and pillars and the inside teller counter bottom and stuff. Everybody had a piece of it. And they even brought some rocks in that guys found it. There's one up here with a D-like in it. Somebody just found it in the field, and so they brought it in, which is the first initial of my last name. And so it's stuck in the fireplace.
And we're in your old office.
Yes, you're in my old office.
And when's the last time you held regular office hours here?
Oh, probably 20 years ago.
But your kids are both involved in the bank.
Yeah, my children are both involved. My son's the president of Farmer State Bank. My daughter's the vice president. And they do own control now.
And it's a bank that is not small anymore.
No. Goodness sakes, no. We started in Jessup, now we're in... We have 10 branches, but the main bank is in Waterloo, and we have branches in Des Moines, and it's completely different. We do have about the same amount of ag customers and loans that we had in the 80s, but the rest of the portfolio has grown tremendously. So we're a $1.4 billion bank now.
Where's that rate in Iowa? I mean, I don't know.
Oh, we're in the top 20. We're probably about 17th or somewhere in
there. And especially among community banks, they're not that big.
Yeah.
You consider yourself still a community bank?
Yeah.
I mean, the Wells Fargo's, no one's going to catch them.
Yeah, we're the largest bank in Blackhawk County, and that includes the Wells Fargo's deposits in that county. We're the largest one.
Did you ever think it would be that big?
No, never dreamt it. I remember doing a strategic plan about 10 years ago when we were $100 million or $150 million, and my daughter said, well, we got to do this strategic plan up to $500 million in 10 years or something like that. And I thought, whoa. Well, we went right by that, you know.
What drove that?
Business in Waterloo. Got the opportunity to hire some really good officers, some really good loan officers that are aggressive. They go out and call on people, and my son does an outstanding job running it, and it just took off gangbusters.
Was there any concern? Did you see any similarities to 2008? I mean, the banking industry kind of... nationally got a reputation of, you know, we're shuffling a whole bunch of stuff around, but they seem to be doing fine now. Was there anything that reverberated down to the banks of Jessup and Waterloo?
gave us the opportunity to gain a lot of new customers in the metropolitan area.
They were didn't want to be in a big bank anymore.
Well, the big banks started throwing all sorts of silly regulations in and things, so a lot of them chose to do business with the community bank.
It goes back to small town life.
Yeah.
When it's all a relationship, a one-on-one. And I have a good friend that's in banking, and I sometimes talk about him on this podcast. And he is a small town guy from Applington. I mean, he loves the one-on-one. It's all small town, but I know his bank is a pretty big one. That to me hasn't gone away. Of it's still important about relationships. Every business is about relationships.
Yes. Yeah.
That hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed at all.
What is the sheep industry, the lamb industry? Is that about relationships too?
Yeah. Well, you're asking me a good question, Paul, because as 4-H and FFA, we showed livestock for probably 15 years, including full time at the Iowa State Fair and 10 state fairs. We showed sheep, as we always put it, from Minot, North Dakota, to Del Rio, Texas, to Park City, Utah, to Louisville, Kentucky. That was the area we showed sheep in those years, and we had a great time doing it. It was a great family adventure in 4-H, and I enjoyed my time in 4-H, and I spent my 14 years on the Iowa 4-H Foundation, was president for a year, and it's a great part of living in a small town Iowa, the things you can do like that.
Tell me about how you got started in that.
Oh, well, my son wanted to show a pen of three at the county fair, and that's what started it. And then pretty soon he wanted to show some breeding sheep, and so we got some, and we got some more, and then we got some more, and then our local retired FFA instructor had a trophy he gave out every year for the champion flock from the FFA chapter, and so we studied that in the book and went down there with 40 head of sheep and won that. So they could say they had one in the show, in the trophy case for the FFA in town, and yeah.
So you go to Minot to Louisville. Why? What was there a common thread among those fairs, or the people, or the competition?
Well, you get so many friends, and then if somebody comes down at the Iowa State Fair and shows out of Minnesota or South Dakota or North Dakota, you get to know them. They want you to come to their fair, and so you kind of make the whole circuit in the later part of the summer and go out to all of them. And then that was an opportunity to sell breeding stock, and that. Those sheep proceeds put the two kids through college and paid for their college education. So,
the tenets of hard work.
Yeah,
I mean that it's not easy to show an animal at a fair.
Yeah, it is.
It's a lot of work. The Iowa State Fair specifically. We were talking before we started recording that I've spent a lot of time there now, but you used to spend a lot of time there. What do you remember about your time at the Iowa State Fair?
Well, we went
in
2 days before the fair started with all these sheep, and then we had to get them all ready for the shows, and we showed purebred Rambouillets, and we showed Suffolks, purebred Suffolks, and we showed FFA, and then we showed 4-H, and we had two sheep strings because the daughter had one and the son had one, and we wanted to make sure nobody accused us of showing on both shows the same sheep, and then the main string went on with somebody else to Missouri to be showed while we were still there. And then you loaded them all up the last day of the fair and went home.
But a little different than maybe some of the hog shows or the cattle shows where they sell that animal.
Yeah.
And you don't get to take it home.
No. Ours we brought home and put back in the flock. And finally, after the daughter was graduated from Iowa State, my wife thought maybe we should cut down a little of our sheep business. So I made the decision that year to sell them all. So we had a sale on the farm. We sold every head of sheep, and we had people from 14 states come to buy them on the farm and at an auction. So
that wasn't intended to be a business venture. It was something to do. You're saying Rodney wanted three, he wanted a pen of three, and it ended up being something that people from 14 states came. So
yeah.
Again, you just never know how things are going to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you reflect upon that, you talk about people and you talk about time with family. Is there anything else that stands out from that maybe carries over to other parts of your life?
I was fortunate enough the reason that I quit having regular business hours is I started farming the farm or two I bought and with another guy, and then pretty soon I had more farm ground, and then pretty soon I spent a lot of time farming, and so I cut back my hours after my son got out of college and kind of farm full-time pretty near the last 15 years.
And there's two different roads I need to take out of this one. One is you were still involved in the communities in the mid-90s and helped send me to college through a scholarship. I got to give that full disclosure, otherwise the bosses will wonder why am I talking to you. But, I mean, that was something. So you were involved with Wartburg. Why be involved with a place that you didn't graduate from? Kids didn't go there.
Well, I went there 2 years, and then I got to know the president of the university pretty well, and they came around, and they were doing some fundraising, and I helped them. And then he asked me if I'd go on the Board of Regents. So I spent my 14 years in the Board of Regents, and it was really good for me to go to college there after high school here. I was glad I spent the first 2 years at Wartburg. It was a great place. So I started a scholarship fund, which is through the years. We contribute to it quite a bit every year, and it's gotten quite large. So we're happy with all the students we can help.
And the time that you went on a Board of Regents, or at least are involved with Wartburg, was a time when Iowa was struggling, and colleges like that were also trying to play catch-up, coming out of the 80s into the 90s, yeah. A lot of building. Was there any overlap of communities of Iowa and those small colleges and maybe how the vitality sits today in the state?
Well, there was two or three other bankers on there that were good friends and helped them. And Wartburg had a transition about that time. When I went on is when they took over their own endowment money from the Lutheran Church. And there wasn't very much there. It had been spent through the years. And then they had to go out and start raising money and develop those development things. And they've been quite successful at it. So, yeah, there's a certain cynicism as you put all that together.
Because I know one of the guys on the board, at least after, I believe, was Fred Hageman. Was
yes.
Fred one of the guys you knew?
Yeah.
Fred tells the story about comparing communities of similar size in that area. What's the difference between these two? And he says, well, Wartburg's in one and not in the other.
Yeah.
I mean, a town with a college. You had a bank in another town with a college mm-hmm. At one time. Is there something different about those communities?
Well, Waverly is where Wartburg is, and that's a real strong community. We have a bank there now, and it's done very well. We've been really pleased with it and everything. Wartburg's a tremendous town. There's a certain vitality or a certain development aspect in a town like that with a college. It strengthens the town. There's a lot of professional people there. Makes the town a little better. Jessup's fortunate because we're just 15 miles from Waterloo, and we're a bedroom community, and we're one of those rare school districts that continues to grow. You know, we got 1,000 students in the school system, and that's pretty hard in Iowa to have anymore in a small town. My son grandson graduated this year, and I think he had about 50-some in his class, and my granddaughter's class is going to be a sophomore, and she's got 87 in her class. So, I mean, class sizes are coming up rather than going down.
Is that something that needs to be addressed in parts of Iowa, on how population has shifted? I mean, I could tell you about my kids being in a class of 500.
Yeah.
And that's way different than what I had.
Yeah.
Of an experience.
I always laughed at Wartburg as a freshman. There was four of us in a room. And one of them, I graduated in a class of 57, I think is what it was. And the other two of them's classes equaled my class, but the fourth roommate's high school class was larger than Wartburg College. He was from a Chicago school. So it's a good place to learn about people and the different attitudes and outlooks and the problems. And we're so fortunate to have a great school system and be progressive enough to make the community develop.
And sometimes, whether it's Iowa State or Iowa or you and I or Wartburg or wherever, trying to keep those kids from Chicago when they come to Iowa isn't always an easy thing to do, but sometimes those communities, you try to keep those people in the state. Do you see economic importance for a state's health to keep people in the rural areas and not let them all go to larger metros?
Absolutely. Small towns have to grow from within, basically. And if you're sitting in a small town, just like when I figured out one day, we're shipping 1 million bushels of corn out of here. We got to do something with that corn here in order to get the economic benefit out of it. And we did. We figured out how to do it, and it kind of turned a corner, you know, made it a much more prosperous town.
Makes a difference. Little things,
yeah.
A couple of people sticking around
and
having something that was important in the community, whether it's raising scholarship money to allow kids to go, and then some will come back, and you hope that they always keep a fondness for the community and maybe talk to their community banker 20 years after the fact.
Yeah.
Two things I still need to get to. One, during my first year or second year as a reporter, I was in Clear Lake, Iowa, north central part of the state, working, and all of a sudden there's a large fire at a restaurant, and I'm toting a camera around on my shoulder, and all of a sudden I hear this voice. And my dad had told me, well, you know that Spark has a summer home up there, and sure enough, there you were, sitting on the side of this fire scene, leg up in the air. You had just had either you'd broken a leg or had the surgery or something. What happened that day?
Or what? Well, somebody went by at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'd had an accident, and I had a badly broken hip and everything. I rolled one of the antique tractors on top of myself and damaged my legs very bad. So, yeah, I was laid up. I don't remember if I was on crutches or a walker, but anyhow, I was one of the two. But it was just down the street a block, so we had to go watch it. And there's Paul with his camera running around the edge of the fire, and so I had to say something to you, of course. And we had a nice visit that morning, and then you came in this morning. We both remembered that, and we're chuckling about it.
Doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but yep. Sure enough, more than a couple of decades, that fire is come and gone, and the people, I mean, I guess growing up in Iowa, growing up in a small location, it just, to me, it always seems like, and whether it's through market to market, that everybody seems to know everybody, or they know someone from that community. We were talking about somebody from the Iowa State Fair. Did you know? Well, yeah, they were from that town. Well, yeah, I knew that. That's always fun for me. I mean, I would imagine your Iowa Bankers Association meetings were always kind of fun that way, because you could connect, and then if somebody new came onto the board, well, did you know so-and-so?
Yeah. Yeah, we worked with it. We went to Washington, I think, 20 years in a row, my wife and I, lobbying with the Iowa Bankers. Don't do it anymore, but it's time for the next person to take the job and go do it. But we had a lot of enjoyable times and got to know a lot of the bankers very well and talked to the regulators and the Farmers Home Administration and some of these other things in the tough times and try to get them to see our problems, too.
Because it does matter.
Yes.
Because if this area hollows out, it creates a whole other set of problems. It's going to be a lot more expensive to fix. You mentioned the antique tractors. I think if people Google your name, they only see two things. They don't even see banking. They see they still see the sheep, but they also see you and a whole bunch of pictures of Oliver tractors.
Yeah.
How'd that come about?
I had the sheep and I had a shop. And the first tractor I bought happened to be a white, but that's Oliver is a predecessor, and one of my neighbor friends offered me a Super 55 Oliver if I wanted something to work on. So I went back and took the tractor, and I didn't know anything about it. And took the head off it and got somebody to tell me how to put a new head gasket on it, rebuild it, and painted it all, and restored it, and then it just kind of fell into a hobby, and I've done approximately 200 tractors or more, and had two big sales where I sold 70, and I sell tractors most years at Mecum auctions. So
how many are you still holding in the shed?
About 20, 25 probably.
Is that about where you want to keep it, or you keep dribbling some out?
I've lost my help, and I'm getting kind of feeble, so I'm working on one right now, but it takes me quite a bit longer to do them now, let's just put it in.
So is that something you've mostly picked up in retirement?
Yeah.
So that wasn't something you were doing?
No, I do it just as an enjoyment. You can't sit home and on the couch all your life. You got to get up and go and do things. So I get up every morning and have coffee with the guys and go out to the farm and start painting or wrenching or overhauling or fixing something. And when I get them all done, I like them, and then I take them down and sell them, start on another one.
The dust doesn't settle on you very often, does it?
No, we like to keep busy doing things.
As you mentioned how you dove into farming more kind of after you'd worked full-time here, do you identify now more as a farmer or still as a banker?
Well, that's a tough question. Probably 50-50. I can't really answer that one both ways, because I've always... You know, we're still on the board, and we're still very active in the bank, too. So my wife and I don't farm anymore, but I have a son-in-law that farms full-time that My daughter, fortunate enough, married one of the neighborhood boys, and so all the land fit right in with his family's land, and they farm all our farms. When he started farming full-time was the day I retired from farming. Spend my time building tractors.
Do you see challenges that he faces that you didn't face in agriculture?
Well, it's completely different because he graduated from Iowa State in agronomy, and he's got such a technical background compared to mine, and everything is computer-wise and computer-driven and GPS, and it's just a whole new ball game. And he's very technocratic at farming to do. He does an excellent job.
Is that what makes a good farmer now?
Yeah, yeah. The day of a couple of years of high school ag class and going out and farming full-time, you got to really learn how to do it right.
Because technology will leave you behind.
Yeah.
If you don't keep up in today's agriculture.
Yeah.
Do you think at a time, how do you see agriculture in the future? I mean, if we have computers driving the planter and the combine and everything else, what's going to happen in that next 20 years?
Somebody's got to run the computers. It's about what it amounts to. Yeah. We farmed 1,000 acres when I was farming, and we thought that was really big, you know, and now they farm a lot more than that, most of these farmers. So,
does a farm need to be big to make it? I mean, you mentioned
you either have to be big or you have to diversify.
Yeah. You mentioned diversity earlier.
We've got a lot of Amish customers, and there's an example of making the use of the diversification. You know, they build a full vegetable market out there, and they have twice a week they have auctions, and so they got greenhouses, and it's been very fortunate for some of them to be able to stay on the farm. And there's a lot of them are carpenters now too that travel, but you can think of the widow lady that put a greenhouse in that raises enough flower starts and other things that she's comfortably taking care of herself, doesn't have to live with the community or anything.
If I was to walk in saying I wanted a farm, I would need, I always hear all the time from people about, well, how can a young person get started in farming? I like to consider myself young. That's the first part of the question. Two is, if you can't get 10,000 acres, you can't make it. That's not a true statement,
I'm
guessing you're saying.
No.
But how does someone who does want to get started that might not have access to land in today's agriculture?
No, it's very difficult. I know one or two that went to work for a farmer full-time, and he helped them get started. Eventually, they're taking over their operation. But the operations continue to get bigger because the machinery costs so much and everything. You got to cover a lot of acres to spread the cost out, and it's just like many things, you know. Every little town doesn't have a school anymore, you know. There are no country schools sitting on the corner, you know, and all this kind of thing. It's a change in our lifestyle.
And you get to see it all. You've seen a whole lot of progress.
Yeah.
From sweeping the floors or sweeping the sidewalks to handing out Tootsie Pops for all these rocks to showing sheep at the fair. It's been quite a journey for you.
Yeah.
When you look back at it all, what are we going to remember most about you?
I always try to judge a person by whether they've been a good citizen, and I think that's probably about the best thing you can hope for, somebody judge you whether you're a good citizen. I'm going to leave here now, and I'm going to go up and help in a Boy Scout booth. That shows you know, how you're a good citizen in a small town.
All right, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much, Sparky.
Yep.
Thanks again to Albert Sparky Durow at Jessup Farmer State Bank. Thank you for watching. We'll see you next time here on the MTOM Show Podcast.